You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
I mean, what's that football focus doing? Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
As a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFL.
Ready to get into it?
Yeah.
All right. We're going team by team.
I would be very careful about slinging stuff.
Am I going to get sued?
We got legal on this?
Let's send you out on the right note. PFF sucks. Have a great day, everybody. Wow.
Welcome in to the PFF NFL podcast. Steve Palazzolo, Sam Monson, coming to you from Radio Media Row here in, where are we? Las Vegas.
Las Vegas,
it's Friday.
Mandalay Bay Convention Center.
It has been a long month this week.
It has, yep.
Here in Vegas. And it's our Friday edition, PFF NFL podcast.
Yeah.
How you doing?
Yeah, survive.
Yeah.
I'm alive. Just.
We haven't even done anything crazy, and I'm exhausted.
Right.
Right? But it's, it's been a good week here.
I had a nice, debate with myself this morning about going to the gym.
Oh, yeah. Who won?
Not me. didn't win the day, but I did shave my head, so.
We won the day on Tuesday. We went to the gym day one.
Yeah.
Have not been back since.
No.
And maybe tomorrow. Maybe tomorrow's the day, Saturday.
Maybe this afternoon. Maybe I'll win the battle later.
You never know. Fun little week here. We've got NFL Honors was last night.
Yep.
Somewhere around here in Vegas. We didn't go to the red carpet. Went to bed instead. But we're going to talk about the awards, little awards reaction. We had news yesterday, Mike Zimmer being hired as the defensive coordinator, going back to the Dallas Cowboys. And we have Dr. Alan Sills, the chief medical officer of the NFL. We put this on YouTube already, but we're going to stick that at the end of the show here, talking to Dr. Alan Sills. We had a very good discussion with him.
Yeah, we had him on last year, and he's actually a really interesting person to talk to. We asked him, gave him some hard-hitting questions, Hey,
I think
how come you're not following the safety, direction? Yeah. And he had some pretty good answers, I think.
I asked him about rule changes maybe leading to more injuries. Is the NFL, I didn't say it this way, but getting a little greedy, getting the money and, causing more injuries. So we'll get into that later in the show. But let's start with the NFL award show. What was your, did you have a biggest surprise coming out of last night?
There weren't that many surprises, I don't think. I guess the comeback player of the year one is probably the most surprising, or the fact that Lamar Jackson's MVP was one vote away from being unanimous. I mean, I think we all expected him to be MVP. For it to be 49-1 felt a little,
too dominant, you would say.
Yeah, like
the
thing that defined this year was that there was no, obvious unanimous consensus MVP for basically the entirety of the year. And then the 49ers game happened and everyone went, "All right, Lamar did it. MVP."
Right.
At least everyone, 49 of the 50 people, of whom I am one.
You're one of the 50.
I am.
You are. I saw the list. It's a decent list overall, plus Emmanuel Acho. I mean, it's not it's a good list of people, and you are one of them.
Thank you. Thank you.
It was weird because the MVP race was completely wide open and then turned into one of the most lopsided votes in history. And I'm not saying Lamar didn't deserve it or anything. I think he did.
Yeah.
It was fine. But I don't think it should have been as dominant. I thought that there would be more first place votes. It became very narrative driven toward the end because Lamar peaked at the end in the Dolphins game, particularly that 49ers game on Christmas night.
Like, Brock Purdy was a few weeks away from being, the consensus MVP, and he got zero first place votes. He only got 9 second place votes. Like, his candidacy was destroyed the day that Lamar's was built.
I think there's the comeback player of the year award. My initial takeaway on that, Joe Flacco getting it over DeMar Hamlin and probably the Lamar stuff.
With eight fewer first place votes.
Yes, we'll talk about why that is. I mean, we joke on here about how even keel we are, and you know, we try to, you know, bring some level-headed analysis here.
Yeah, people hate that.
People can't stand that.
Right.
But you know, I think that nothing sums up the recency bias stuff than the Comeback Player of the Year award. And maybe Lamar Jackson having 49 votes. By the way, you know, congrats to Lamar Jackson.
Incredible. Absolutely.
You know, second MVP.
Two-time MVP.
Youngest player to have an MVP.
And to be clear, as one of the 49 people that voted for him, I do agree that he should be the MVP.
Yeah, I'm just
surprised that it was 49.
I agree with you. But the one person who voted against is getting some hate. It's Aaron Schatz, formerly of Football Outsiders, now of FTN. Fade the noise, I believe. Schatz is like defended himself. Why did he have Josh Allen first and Dak Prescott second, I believe? And it's like, dude, I thought more people would have that take. I stand with Aaron, at least having not necessarily the exact take, but I thought more people would go down that path.
Aaron was one of those people who wrote up his awards and his AP, basically his ballot, right, for the All-Pro and for his awards. Wrote the whole thing up in an article, explained his logic in each and every pick. And I don't mean yesterday. I mean, he did this, you know, weeks ago when he put in the ballot. And, you know, there's people out there going, this is just a contrarian pick to drive people to your website, to clicks. Like, the man wrote it up weeks ago, right? He didn't know it was going to be controversial at the time he wrote it up. I didn't think it was going to be 49-1.
You're not, like, the 50 voters don't get together and, like, raise their hand. It's all
so
secret ballot.
I would say, look, if you want to dignify the guy with reading his explanation. If you don't want to, if you think he's still full of it, fine. That's your prerogative. I think he's wrong. I voted for the other guy. But, you know, he's not doing that just to drive clicks to his website. Like, he wrote this up weeks ago. If you want to go read his explanation, go read his explanation. You know, but it's his opinion, and I don't think it's a crazy one.
So congrats to Lamar Jackson on the MVP. I think that was well-deserved, well-earned. We're just, you know, breaking down the breakdown of the votes. I want to talk about Comeback Player of the Year and what happened there. But first, is 2024 bringing exciting or unexpected changes to your life? Here's a secret weapon to help you face those challenges with more confidence. It's a great term life insurance policy. That's right. Fabric by Gerber Life makes it simple to protect your family's financial future so you can focus on what's ahead, knowing your family is protected if something else unexpected happens. Fabric was designed by parents for parents to help you get a high-quality, surprisingly affordable term life insurance policy in less than 10 minutes. Fabric has flexible policies that fit your family and your budget, like $1 million in coverage for less than a dollar a day. Get your personalized quote in just minutes and apply when it's convenient for you. It's all online and on your schedule. You can go from start to covered in less than 10 minutes with no health exam required. So join the thousands of parents who trust Fabric to protect your family. Apply today in just minutes at meetfabric.com/PFFNFL. That's meetfabric.com/PFFNFL. meetfabric.com/PFFNFL. Policy is issued by Western Southern Life Insurance Company, not available in certain states. Prices subject to underwriting and health questions. By the way, as I did the other day when Dan Marino walked by, I will point out if I see somebody really important or, you know, fun or whatever it might
like
be.
Like Greg Olson right there.
We just talked to Greg Olson.
We did.
We gave him kudos. We said, good job, Greg. You do a great job on the broadcast. And he said, hey, thanks for all you do.
Yeah.
To Sam and Steve.
He did.
So
Greg thinks we do a good job, too.
It was And one of the guys with him was like, hey, big fan of the show.
Absolutely.
He's probably listening right now. So it was great running into people over here. So Comeback Player of the Year Award.
Yeah.
I thought it was a lot. I thought this was like the easiest award ever. DeMar Hamlin came back from death, had the most first place votes, but did not win the award. In favor of Joe Flacco.
It's interesting. So usually the AP has only been doing this for a couple of years where they've awarded a point system, right? You have first place, second place, third place, you get different points for each one. So it isn't just who got more first place votes. That's the way it used to be done. Now it's who got the most points when you add in essentially a ranked choice system. I think generally speaking, that is an improvement and a good way of doing it. Eventually,
agreed,
we're going to get an MVP much like this, who wins MVP with fewer first place votes than the guy that didn't win MVP, and that's going to cause all kinds of chaos. I do think, however, that in this very, very specific instance, the ranked choice system probably ends up producing a bad result. Now, it was very close. Joe Flacco has 151 points, DeMar Hamlin has 140, but eight more people thought that DeMar Hamlin was the Comeback Player of the Year than Joe Flacco. But because of the nature of his comeback, right? And, you know, Comeback Player of the Year is a very, like, nebulous, you know, difficult to define award, which is the whole
thing. My least favorite award, Sam.
Right, I know, and a lot of people's, which is why it's very difficult to define and articulate and all those kinds of things. But basically people with DeMar Hamlin fell into one of two camps. Either they were like, well, he's clearly the comeback player of the year, the same way Alex Smith was when he came back from almost having his leg amputated. It didn't matter how much he played. It didn't matter whether he played well. Simply stepping back on an NFL field after what he went through makes him comeback player of the year. You either fell into that camp, which you and I are both in, or you fell into the camp of saying, he wasn't even good and he didn't play when he came back. Therefore, how can he be comeback player of the year? We need to give it to a guy that played and played well. Now, so anyone in that camp basically didn't even have Hamlin on the ballot, right? They're like, he's not comeback player of the year at all. I'm going Baker Mayfield 1, Joe Flacco 2, Tua Tagovailoa 3, you know, whatever. So I think a ranked choice system hurts DeMar Hamlin's case in an unusual way that is usually not applicable.
You're right. You're either all in or all out.
Right.
When it comes to DeMar Hamlin.
Now, that being said, I do think it's vaguely funny that 7 people of the voters had him second. 7 people processed this and said, that's a really impressive comeback. The man died on the field. You know, we didn't know if he was going to have brain damage for like several days afterwards. We certainly didn't think he was going to play again. He got all the way back. He played in an NFL game. He played, you know, whatever it was, 15, 20 snaps over the regular season, more in the playoffs. Really impressive comeback, but it's not quite as impressive as just an old man coming off the couch and playing mid-ball for 6 games. 7 people came to that conclusion. 14 people came to the conclusion that it's really impressive, but it's less impressive than old man Flack over 6 games and one other dude, like Stafford coming back from being hurt for a while. I don't understand that as a process. Like, those people have some questions for.
I completely agree with you on the all or nothing aspect of this affecting Hamlin and the award. I think this is a good time for me to rail against the recency bias of the human brain and the current news cycle that we live in here. You know, what if, hypothetically, DeMar Hamlin had the on-field incident in, say, I don't know, November, and was able to come back by the end of December, right, within the same season? Would that change your vote? Like, well, he came back from death. Now, the fact that he did it in 2 months versus 7 months, okay, would that have changed things?
I think it's a Flacco specific thing. I mean, even it's the fact that Flacco's run happened right at the end.
And it went
into the playoffs.
It also wins the award probably any other year because he came off the couch and led a playoff team.
But the point being, it's the fact that it happened acutely at the end of the season, right when the votes are going in. That's the recency bias at work, because if you take Flacco out of this, Hamlin beats Baker Mayfield, who had what is just a conventional comeback, right?
Right,
he was bad last year. He wasn't expected to be a starter. And this year he came in and played well. Yeah. Like, Baker is the conventional comeback player of the year story. And in a year without Joe Flacco and DeMar Hamlin, Baker Mayfield wins comeback player of the year over Matthew Stafford, over Tua and his concussions, over, you know, Breece Hall, Brock Purdy, Calvin Ridley, blah, blah, blah. Baker is your conventional comeback player of the year. DeMar Hamlin is a, you know, once ever story. So DeMar Hamlin trumps the usual comeback player story of Baker Mayfield. And then only Joe Flacco rocking up with like the last month of the season and going on this acute run into the playoffs, like, jacks the whole thing sideways, and the recency bias makes him comeback player of the year.
It's recency bias in favor of Flacco. It happened late, but also against Hamlin because that happened last year. In January.
Right, but I think when both of those happen at the same time is it effective.
But this is what's driving me crazy, man. Like, do people forget? Football shut down for a few days.
Yeah.
Like, we didn't even know if there was going to be games. The whole playoff structure got changed. They canceled a game. Like, they canceled the Bills-Bengals game. They didn't restart it.
Which is, like, the first time ever that happened, right?
Right.
It's the first game that's been abandoned in ever.
We had to do multiple podcasts that week. You know, trying to make sense of things, and like, we couldn't talk really about anything else, right? Football stopped. The sports world kind of stopped a little bit for a few days to kind of figure out what was going on here. And eventually, you came back and you there was more normalcy after that. But it was just an amazing story every step of the way. People want to know, you know, how's Hamlin doing? You know, and then even just like standing up and taking a first step and waving to people and all these different things. Like, that happened within the last calendar year of when these votes were placed. And we still forgot it because Joe Flacco played 5 games. To me, it's just more a microcosm of how the news cycle in our mind works to like the last thing that we saw.
And also because
not the most impactful thing that we saw.
Because his recovery has been so complete and he's gotten back onto the field and onto an NFL field, something that most people never achieve in the first place, people assume that was always a given, right? At the time, like when it happened, they got him, you know, they got his heart starting again, they got him into the hospital. He was in a coma for like a couple of days.
Right.
When he was in the coma, a lot of medical professionals were saying for the amount of time that he was down, his brain was starved from oxygen. There is a very good chance that he is brain damaged at this point and may not live a normal life at all, let alone come back and play in an NFL game. So we can't like revise history and go, ah, once they got it going again, like once he undied on the field, it was all smooth sailing from that point on.
He's
right?
Just a special teamer.
Right. It was all easy from then. Like it was a very real. We did not think that this guy was going to play football again.
To me, it's just a microcosm of the world we're in right now and the way people react. I mean, again, a year ago before the AFC Championship, there was discussion that, well, if Joe Burrow beats Patrick Mahomes, Joe Burrow is the best quarterback in the NFL.
Right.
Now it's like, Patrick Mahomes leads the Chiefs to 17 points, plays really well, by the way. But this, because they made it to the next Super Bowl, Patrick Mahomes is the greatest quarterback of all time now because this game happened.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, we just can't have a normal, Matthew Stafford won the Super Bowl. Put him in the Hall of Fame. There's no other way. There's no middle ground.
Yeah.
He's not just a very good quarterback. Like, everything is at the extreme right now.
Yep. There's no normal anymore.
Anyway, it's the most we're ever going to talk about the Comeback Player of the Year award.
Cool.
I hope. Defensive Player of the Year, Sam.
Yeah.
You had a good day yesterday, overall.
Myles Garrett won.
I haven't seen you smile in, I don't know, forever.
Yeah.
And you were smiling. We had a good lunch yesterday. We had a good lunch. You were happy. And that night, Myles Garrett wins Defensive Player of the Year.
Yeah.
Not because you're biased, but because you just, you know.
I was
you
simply.
Think the right guy won.
I do think the right guy won, and I was simply happy that my mentions were not quite the dumpster fire they would have been had T.J. Watt won. And, you know, it was interesting. It was close.
Very
Myles
close
Garrett,
vote.
23 first-place votes compared with 19 for T.J. Watt, 7 for Micah Parsons, which results in 165 points for Garrett, 140 for T.J. Watt, and then 89 for Micah Parsons. Micah Parsons, by the way, who came out and said that Myles Garrett was Defensive Player of the Year. Like a guy that other people, largely Steelers fans, have been saying, Micah Parsons has a stronger case for Defensive Player of the Year than Myles Garrett. Like, look at the numbers. Garrett or Micah Parsons came out and said that's a stupid take. Garrett was the best defensive player this season. Watch the tape. Don't just look at stats. So, look, Steelers fans have been doing that for months already. It's like, look at the stats. Garrett only had, you know, one sack at the end of the season. Yada, yada, yada. The players, the AP voters, Micah Parsons, people watching the tape recognize that Myles Garrett was a dominant force, even if he wasn't in the playoff game and therefore deserved Defensive Player of the Year.
My quick summation on that is, you know, because we've been defending this for a while.
Yeah.
It's not that we're not downplaying the importance of the sack on the for the defense.
Correct.
Sacks are awesome. The two points I want to make is there's other ways to create production in the NFL than any traditional stat that keeps being posted out there. There are other ways besides sacks, tackles for losses, passes defensed, or whatever else is being thrown out there. There's other ways to provide production. And then, yes, the sack is very important. And usually when you win very quickly, you're either going to get those sacks or maybe someone else on your team is. Or it's going to force an incompletion or an interception. All that stuff matters. All you can do is isolate what the player brings to the table. And I agree, Myles Garrett deserves Defensive Player of the Year.
Yeah, and the final point I'll make about this is it is not disrespect or hate to suggest that a man was in the top five best defensive players in the NFL
no,
in a given season.
It's not disrespect.
Right. So nobody is saying T.J.
Watt
feels
disrespected. He's upset.
Right. T.J. feels upset. Nobody is saying he had a bad year. Nobody is saying he wasn't good. Nobody's saying he wasn't great. We're simply saying he was not Defensive Player of the Year. As, by the way, were the players. As, by the way, has Micah Parsons said. It is fact now.
I think T.J. Watt is great. He is an awesome player.
Correct.
I think the voters got it right, though.
Yeah.
Other interesting stories coming out of the voting. C.J. Stroud, AP Offensive Rookie of the Year.
Also almost unanimous.
And teammate Will Anderson, AP Defensive Rookie of the Year, the number 2 and 3 pick of the NFL draft.
That one was closer.
People are looking for apologies from me.
Yep, they are.
And you, in a moment of weakness, while we were at dinner last night, saying, you know, maybe it's justified. The Will Anderson trade is justified.
Yep.
And I can't believe you said that.
I apologize.
Based off a Defensive Rookie of the Year award, just because he got awarded things. Like, nothing's changed since the season. We saw Will Anderson play. He was awesome. At the time, we said, Will Anderson, probably going to be awesome. Big fan of Will Anderson, one of my favorite players in the draft. So, I don't know. My take hasn't changed. But you apparently have changed because he has an award now and you think trade justified.
Yeah, I do. I do think trade has been justified. I think they got it right. You can ultimately, because we don't know what any of these players are going to be, right? There is an unknown element to all of this, which is what are you going to get with the picks? And that's why we focus on process over results, because you never are entirely sure. And the chances are, as we were saying, our argument was, the chances are there's no way that these players can be good enough to justify the picks that they gave up, because you're talking more players and they're high value. And if you sort of plot out the averages and the probabilities, they're better off staying with the picks that they had and sacrificing Will Anderson Jr. But CJ Stroud has been Offensive Rookie of the Year and looked like one of the best quarterback prospects to enter the league ever in terms of his immediate performance.
He's not a part of the trade-up discussion, though.
Will Anderson has won Defensive Rookie of the Year and looks like an extremely good defensive player. So now what you're looking at, and so the third element of that is the pick that they gave up, or now one of the picks that they've given up, because they were so damn good right out of the gate, is what, 26 overall?
Yep.
So they are going to have given up 26 overall, 33 last year, to make that move. I'm okay with that. 26 okay. Plus 33 equals Will Anderson. I believe that now has been proven to be a fair trade. Therefore, I apologize for saying that the Texans were bad, stupid, and shouldn't have done it. They got it right.
That's very nice of you. You really are in a good mood.
The ends justify the means, yeah. And the ends were proven correct at this point. I still think it was iffy process, but if you're going to have... Look, sometimes you're going to put we're in Vegas. Sometimes you're going to place a bet that does not have a high chance of coming off. If it comes off, fair play, tip of the cap, fair fucks to you. Fair fucks to the Texans.
I'm still kind of in wait and see mode. Not that you're not happy as a Texans fan. I will also say, with the history of trading up for non-quarterbacks not being great, if you're going to trade up for a 99th percentile model player, 98th percentile model player like Will Anderson, I do believe your hit rate's going to be higher, and
right.
I think that is a good play. So yeah, I always said Will Anderson's going to be an excellent player, but I don't think you feel as great as the Texans were this year, getting things back on track and winning the division, winning a playoff game. I don't think you feel the effects of this trade until maybe a year or two from now. Because, you know, we did a mock draft yesterday from the Cabana over at Circa. And they have a pick at 25 where they can get a, you know, starting caliber player.
25 or 26?
20, whatever it is. In the 20s. They have a pick where they can get a starting caliber player. Sorry.
27?
27.
Even better. I apologize even
so
more.
So there's still a player, right? You're still going into the draft right now without a first rounder. The pick 32 was it 32? You're missing out on a player like a Joey Porter Jr., and you're missing out on what, another third round player. You know, we're not going to say it's always going to be the best player. You know, that's a less of
well,
a
no,
hit,
they
right?
flipped. They got a third back in it, so the third I think evens itself out.
We'll say it evens itself. So I mean, it's still like a Joey Porter Jr. and a player at 12, right? And this year's first round.
So it ends up being
they would have gone somebody at 12,
right?
They would have gone somebody early second round. Am I right on that?
It ends up being 27 and 30. Three for and Will Anderson for 12, the other player they could have gotten instead.
So
it's Will Anderson.
Right, so it's whoever they could have gotten at 12.
Yeah.
And the next guys off the board, Jameer Gibbs, Lucas Van Ness, Broderick Jones, Will
it's
McDonald.
It's the other player plus 27 and 33 or Will Anderson.
Correct. And who could those players have been? I said Joey Porter Jr. He's off the board. It could have been the next guy, non-quarterback off the board, was Sam Laporta, right? And so this is what I'm talking about when doing the math. If Houston, would Houston rather have, let's just do the exact picks. Pick 12 was the Lions picks. You could have Jahmyr Gibbs,
right?
Sam Laporta, and the 27th pick in
you
this year's draft.
You can't do who could they have had.
I'm giving examples. Yeah. This is who they literally who they could have drafted.
Yeah, but you can't do it that way because that's always going to produce an optimal, like that's the 100th percentile range of outcomes.
No, those are literally just the next players off the board.
Yeah, but that's
they
not,
also could have had, okay, like a worse scenario. They could have had Will McDonald, right, who went a few picks later.
How dare you.
They could have had Matthew Bergeron and the 27th pick. Right? So it could have gone poorly.
Yeah.
But again, like the math behind this is still like a 3-for-1, basically.
I mean,
and even if Will Anderson's great, which I think his trajectory
Jameer Gibbs
is
the actual
good.
Pick. The very next pick was Lucas Van Ness. Like, it could have been a lot worse.
Yeah,
so you can't look at it as like, here's who they could have had.
Been Lucas Van Ness, Jonathan Mingo, and the 27th pick this year.
Right. So it's a range of outcomes. So that's the whole point. It's always a gamble. So the fact that they got the gamble correctly, that they nailed their pick, they got Will Anderson, is worth something.
Yeah.
And I believe it's worth.
I'm not even being critical of it right now. I'm just saying, like there's still wait and see aspects to it because it affects your team building going forward. It affects your depth going forward to put all your eggs into one player basket.
Yeah, but that one That's player all. Appears to be very good.
Oh, I agree. I thought so at the time that he was very good. So congrats to the Texans is the bottom line here. C.J. Stroud and Will Anderson.
Fair fucks to them.
Let's talk a little prize picks. We got a lineup for this weekend.
How many of those can I drop before this thing has to be demonetized?
I think you're done. Patrick Mahomes, we're going more than a half passing yard. We got a special freebie with Patrick Mahomes, theoretically, as long as he doesn't throw for negative passing yards here. Brandon Ayuk, part of our PFF prize picks lineup. Brandon Ayuk going more than 62.5 receiving yards. Isaiah Pacheco going more than a half rushing and receiving touchdown. We have Patrick Mahomes plus Brock Purdy going more than 38.5 rushing yards combined. Chris Jones going more than a quarter of a sack, so we need a half sack or more. And then Christian McCaffrey going more than 90.5 rushing yards this weekend in the big game. So that's our Prize Picks lineup for this week. You guys can also play along over at Prize Picks, and it's a good time to do it because if I could find it over here, I'm going the wrong way. It's the wrong way. Wish we had these in order. Because we have the Patrick Mahomes free square that I already told you about. If Mahomes throws for one or more yard, you win. An extra layer of excitement is added to the big game with Prize Picks, and you take advantage of that exclusive Patrick Mahomes free square offer. If Patrick Mahomes throws for more than 1 yard during the Super Bowl, you win. You can win a prize by rooting for one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL. Don't miss your chance to get in on the action and win big with Prize Picks. Sign up now. Claim that free square. Prize Picks is the largest daily fantasy sports platform in North America. The easiest, most exciting way to play DFS is just you against the numbers. Pick more. Pick less. It's that easy. Instead of battling thousands of other players, including pros and sharks, you pick more than or less than a 2-6 player stat projection. Watch the winnings roll in. You play alongside some of Prize Picks' favorite players like rapper Meek Mill and comedian Andrew Schultz. You could do that. Just find the community plays under the promos tab of the app to view entries from some of the biggest names in the Prize Picks community each week. Prize Picks even offers a reboot policy so their entries stay in play even if one of your players gets injured. For football and basketball games, you have a player that exits the game in the first half, doesn't return in the second, that player is rebooted. Prize Picks is the only daily fantasy sports platform with an injury insurance policy. So go to prizepicks.com/PFFNFL. Use code PFFNFL. You get a first deposit match up to $100. Great week to do this. prizepicks.com/PFFNFL. Use code PFFNFL for a first deposit match up to $100. Pick more, pick less. It's that easy. Over at Prize Picks. All right, man. Anything else from an awards perspective from last night? Coach of the Year?
Yeah, PFF Bobby did not win Assistant Coach of the Year. He was fourth in the ranking. Jim Schwartz was the fairly runaway number one guy. Mike McDonald number two. Ben Johnson number three. PFF Bobby number four.
Browns and Texans mopping up
the
awards.
And then Stefanski, right, won overall Coach of the Year by a tiebreaker. So
they both had Kevin Stefanski and D'Amico Ryans both had 165 total points.
Right. And so Stefanski won because one more voter voted Stefanski first place over D'Amico Ryans. So a tiebreak in overall points went with the guy with the most first place votes. Stefanski number one, D'Amico Ryans number two, Dan Campbell number three, Kyle Shanahan number four, John Harbaugh number five. No sign whatsoever of Matt LaFleur.
You were a big LaFleur fan, right?
LaFleur had two third place votes.
Was he your third?
He was in my list somewhere. I remember talking about him with
you when you were going over your list. I mean, LaFleur, most of the time this is a did you exceed expectations type of award. And Stefanski, when you have, I know they had five starting quarterbacks technically. They were already clinched, in the, right? It was at five. But basically with four starting quarterbacks, they made the playoffs, won double-digit games. So that's why Stefanski won. That's why Jim Schwartz won as coordinator of the year. Turned that Browns defense around from very bad to very good. I'm surprised Dan Campbell only got 33 points compared to the 165 that tied for the lead between Stefanski and DeMeco Ryans. I thought Dan Campbell would get a lot more love
for the
division win, but they had 9 wins last year, right. So with your expectations higher.
So that's the thing. You have to bear in mind these awards are done as soon as the regular season is wrapped, right? Nothing in the playoffs. Everything in the playoffs happens after these awards are voted for, right? So Dan Campbell, the Lions were expected to be good this year. They were good. They won the division, but the legacy got burnished a bit by getting to the NFC Championship game, taking it to the 49ers, almost beating them, and then coming up just short. That, I think, is sort of what makes you think, Dan Campbell probably should have got more love. But if you just look at the regular season, it was more of an as-expected, par for the course.
So that's it on the awards.
Offensive
last
player
night.
Of the year, right?
You want to talk about it?
I mean, just might as well wrap them up with all of them, right?
All right, AP Offensive Player of the Year, where is that?
It was Christian McCaffrey fairly comfortably over Tyreek Hill.
I didn't think it would be that comfortable.
No, I mean, those are the two obvious candidates, but I went the other order, but I think either one is fair.
Christian McCaffrey, Tyreek Hill, CeeDee Lamb, then Lamar Jackson, Dak Prescott. Again, another interesting award. You're taking value out of it. You're just it's less of a QB award and more about let's get other positions in there. McCaffrey, definitely well deserved with his as a runner and receiver and what he does for that 49ers offense. Travis Etienne got a third place vote.
Yeah, they did. That's got to be Acho.
Some of the random one off votes are always interesting, of which you've had before.
Yeah,
you've been one of those guys.
How many of them do you think are Acho?
Does Acho know who Travis Etienne is?
Probably.
The man's job is to sling takes.
Yes.
Every weekend.
Yeah.
Extreme ones.
Mm-hmm.
Every week, after a weekend. I can't imagine him and Travis Etienne have crossed paths often when he's take slinging. You know what I mean? Of course he knows who he is, I think. But of all the 50 voters who might not know who he is,
if I had to pick one, he would be the one.
I've noticed we're very aggressive at just criticizing people here lately.
Yeah,
just
we're tired and cranky, though.
On the prowl, on the attack here.
We were talking to Trevor Sikkema earlier in the week, and he was ground down at that point, and he was saying, man, when I get tired, I get cranky, and I was in line, I was shouting at the guy in front of me for doing something stupid in my head. I'm like, dude, you are not in the same ballpark in terms of crankiness when you get angry.
We let it out.
We just start ragging people on the podcast when we're cranky.
Mike Lepardi,
publicly,
Emmanuel
Acho. To millions and millions of listeners.
It's not even strays. These are like direct punches. I mean, these are jabs.
These are
overhand
shots.
Right. I mean, we are bringing
these These are well-aimed, targeted strikes.
Yes.
Right to the head.
No strays here, right. PFF NFL podcast. Mike Zimmer. Mike Zimmer news. Mike Zimmer going to the Cowboys, a return to the Cowboys. He was there between 1994 and sometime in the mid-2000s. 06?
How precise of you.
I saw it the other day. I think it's 94 to 06.
Okay.
Mike Zimmer going back to the Cowboys, 67-year-old defensive coordinator. Your thoughts?
I like it. I think Mike Zimmer, even towards the end of his Minnesota tenure when the Vikings defense overall fell off, it was still really good on third downs. Like, he still clearly had teeth and the ability to design good plays at the right time. Now he gets to go back. I think there's a lot of merit generally to these guys who get to go back to being a coordinator. And by that, I mean they get a whole bunch of crap taken off their plate. All the other 17 jobs that come with being a head coach.
Defense.
Doesn't have to do any of that anymore. He's just a coordinator. Go coach defense. Get your players where they need to be. Get your scheme where it needs to be. Spend all your time doing that. And the Dallas Cowboys defense has amazing personnel. We've seen that over the last couple of years. So I think it's a really good appointment.
How would you describe his defense? I think, they do a lot of trickeration at the line of scrimmage, a lot of double A gap, sugaring the A gaps, as our friend Greg Cosell likes to say. But it's a four-man, right? There's some similarities to Jim Schwartz there, where he still wants to win with four up front, but the blitz packages and the third down defense has always been really good for Zimmer. How would you describe his defense?
I think it's perfect for the way the league is going right now on defense, which is to increase the frequency and the the amount of that trickery and misdirection and disguise that's going on, whether it's with, you know, linebackers in the A gap, whether it's with rotating safeties pre and post snap, like pressure looks, all those kinds of things. Zimmer already did all that stuff with his defense, so it's not, you know, it's a slightly different scheme. It's not the same necessarily as that Mike McDonald defense, but it's the same idea. Like, that's the kind of stuff that Zimmer excelled at anyway.
I think it's interesting, too, when you look at the division and what the Eagles just had to deal with and how bad they were at handling blitz packages. And I know they've got Kellen Moore in there, and it's a new offensive system, and they'll, you know, maybe have better answers against the blitz. But remember, there were points in Zimmer's career, they would play the Lions twice a year, and there were times where they just broke the Lions' pass protection rules. There was that one game, I think Stafford got sacked 7 or 8 times, and it wasn't because the offensive line was getting beaten up, it was because they just couldn't block it. They didn't know who to block.
Right.
And they just out-schemed the Lions at that particular time. Zimmer has a lot of those games under his belt historically, and I think that's an interesting matchup going up against the Eagles in particular, and how Jalen Hurts didn't really handle the blitz, and the whole system, the team didn't handle the blitz, so they're going to have answers. So it's two new coordinators and everything, but the teams they're going up against, right? I mean, who are the Cowboys trying to beat? What's the hump they're trying to get over? It's the Eagles. It's the 49ers. It's all the best teams in the NFC. And look, Dan Quinn, I think, did a really good job there, but I think this is at least a lateral type of move.
Yeah.
Bringing Zimmer in for Dan Quinn.
I mean, Dan Quinn leaving was a big blow to this defense. He's done a fantastic job over the last couple of years. If you're Dallas, you're like, how do we avoid going backwards losing Dan Quinn? I think Mike Zimmer avoids going backwards. So I think it's a really nice hire.
So there you go, Mike Zimmer going to the Dallas Cowboys. How long have we been going? Time to go to Dr. Allen?
Just one last, one last programming note. I got an email coming in from somebody, one of the people, our loyal listeners, that won a bet from us over the weekend, basically saying, how do I redeem my free PFF Plus subscription? With the Super Bowl and everything else, haven't gotten around to those yet, but I will do that next week. I will get all those accounts set up. I won't personally, but I will send it to somebody that will.
Yeah, other programming note, we're going to be back to our old school 3-podcast-a-week schedule. And you know, we're going to get back to that same cadence that we used previously, that Monday, Wednesday, Thursday cadence. Monday, I don't know if we're going to do it this Monday, but we'd like in the off season leading up to the draft to talk mock drafts, a little mock draft Monday, because mock starts with M and Monday starts with M, and I think that works well. So nice. Mock draft Mondays coming up, you know, different ways that we like to talk draft. Free agency's coming up soon. I think within the next couple weeks we'll be fixing every team in 5 minutes or less.
Perfect.
Right, as we always tend to do. So we got all that stuff coming up, but we'll be going back to 3 days a week next week from a mock draft standpoint.
Nice.
Any name drops? You want to name drop anybody around here? Who are you seeing? The Rock was here yesterday. Extra security. I could not get close to The Rock.
Did you try?
I just wanted to say, hey, Rock, you're my high school baseball coach's girlfriend's niece's husband.
Right.
I just wanted to say hello. You know, we are connected, couple degrees of separation.
And you were bodied,
you know,
by
big
the security?
I couldn't even get into the bathroom over there.
Right.
There's like 15 people. Why does The Rock need security? Why does he need that level of security?
I'm just saying, I feel like if you'd taken a run at it, you could have at least beaten one of them.
Yeah, I didn't time it up well. I mean, if he shows up again today, maybe we'll take a chance.
I mean, those guys, like, you got a question. You're The Rock security, right? You're generally on the lookout for, you know, potential threats, but you're not, like, braced for contact.
What's up, man? How you doing?
You know?
Good to see you.
You're not taking a pass set ready to stop a giant 6'10" lug launching himself at you. I feel like
you're
could have taken a run and beaten one guy.
All right, if we see like a high-end celebrity walks around here, maybe I'll take some chances here today.
Okay.
Later.
That's all I'm asking. Trust yourself. Trust your speed.
Oh,
trust your size.
We didn't talk about the Hall of Fame. Do you want to do a quick Hall of Fame reaction?
Sure.
From last night? Did we add that? We can add that.
2024 class. Dwight Freeney, edge rusher. Devin Hester, kick return, punt return specialist. Andre Johnson, wide receiver. Julius Peppers, edge rusher. Patrick Willis, linebacker. Randy Gradishar and Steve McMichael from the senior committee.
A lot of guys that we have. Now we have more guys where we like have their entire PFF career.
Right.
A guy like Patrick Willis, who was one of our top linebackers year in, year out. Dwight Freeney going in, Julius Peppers, you got two defensive ends there.
Julius Peppers, the only guy that was a first ballot guy this year.
Yeah, and we're already looking forward to next year's first ballot guy like Luke Kuechly. He's
right.
Already on the ballot next year, man.
Yeah. Luke Kuechly on the ballot for the first time in the same year as Adam Vinatieri.
I'm fine
it's
with
like
this.
25 years between them.
Oh
in
my
age.
Gosh, it's crazy. Yeah, Vinatieri started his career in like 96. So, I mean, he was in the year 15 or 16 when Keighley entered the league.
And they're in the same Hall of Fame class.
Yeah, I thought the class was good. A guy like Antonio Gates probably gets snubbed.
Yeah, definitely.
I think Gates will get in at
Gates
some point.
Gates has 116 career touchdowns. That's 100. More than Tony Gonzalez, who's like the everlasting tight end record right. guy and everything.
And Steve Largent of the Seahawks at one point was like, you know, he had 100. Like 100 used to be this.
Yeah. I mean,
you know,
Don Hudson had 99, right? Yeah. And that was the record for like a half a century
yeah.
until Largent broke it.
And I know there's more scoring nowadays and there's more games or whatever, but yeah, 100 used to be a big milestone.
I mean, it still is a pretty freaking big milestone.
But yeah, Gates was unbelievable, man. He was uncoverable in his prime. Former basketball player. I don't know if you knew that.
I've heard that once or
but
twice.
But yeah, we have faith Antonio Gates will get in. I still think there's this backlog of receivers, the Torrey Holtz and Reggie Waynes of the world. They did not get in. That
I mean,
should probably be in if they're going to let some others in.
116 touchdowns, still ranks 7th all time. And the only people ahead
He's
of him.
He's 7th all time,
yeah.
Gates?
And the only people ahead of him are obviously wide receivers.
He'll get in. But yeah, good class. Julius Peppers, an absolute freak of a player, picked in the top 5, movement skills, ability, and he had some longevity to him. And then Dwight Freeney, just an unstoppable pass rusher. Not, I mean, he didn't play the run all that well, but it wasn't asked to and was just unreal getting to the quarterback.
Yeah. Yeah, Dwight Freeney was the guy with that unstoppable spin move that nobody could get a handle on for his entire NFL career, even late in his career, you know, bouncing around the league. 6 different teams he played for, only 4 of which I had any recollection of last
night.
Yeah,
we played that game last night. I only got 4 of them, I think.
Right. But he was suiting up, I think, for Arizona and dropping that spin move on Andrew Whitworth when he was still at the peak of his powers, and it still worked, right? Like, that was absolutely incredible. Julius Peppers had amazing longevity. I think he's 4th all-time in the sack list, played for like 17 seasons as an edge rusher. Amazing by him. Andre Johnson, I was kind of surprised, got in that easily, I guess, quote-unquote. He always felt like the underrated guy in his career. All the attention was on Larry Fitzgerald or whoever, and Andre Johnson just kept cooking on his own in Houston, regardless of who the quarterbacks were. And he got in pretty quickly. Like I said, not first ballot, but
I think Andre Johnson was right.
I think he deserves to get in, but I'm surprised it was that comfortable. Like Chris Carter was waiting for like a decade to get in, you know?
Yeah, I think there's a backlog of receivers, and I don't think it's just because of the changes in the game. I think there's just, I don't know, there's receivers that probably need to get in. Looking ahead to next year, Eli Manning on the ballot for the first time, Luke Kuechly, who we mentioned, Marshall Yanda will be a good little test case because I think big PFF guy, Marshall Yanda, we would definitely put him in. I don't know where the voters will land there. Marshawn Lynch, Terrell Suggs, Darren Sproles, Joe Staley, Aqib Talib, Demaryius Thomas, Clay Matthews, Ryan Khalil, just some of the names who will be eligible next year.
Yep.
All right. Well, it's been fun over here on Radio Media Row. We're going to try to set up Sunday night right after the game and give you your Hall of Fame recap. Appreciate everybody tuning in. Go check out our other shows this week. We did free agency preview. We did a mock draft from Circa. Shout out again to Circa, an unbelievable sports book. Great place to watch the big game if you're in Vegas here on Sunday. But for now, we're going to go to Dr. Alan Silt, the chief medical officer of the NFL, breaking down some of the hard-hitting questions, Sam, about player health and safety here. Appreciate everybody. We'll see you again next week with more PFF NFL podcast. And we're joined by Dr. Alan Sills, Chief Medical Officer in the NFL. You joined us last year with Sam. Appreciate having you back.
Thanks for having me.
Sam, you want to kick things off?
Yeah. We had an injury expert in our podcast this year talking about all the week's injuries. One of the things we seemed to spend our entire time doing was talking about hamstring injuries. And was there a big uptick in soft tissue injuries in the NFL this year? I think there's some kind of initiative to kind of really dive into that. Did you guys learn anything from that? And are there going to be sort of preventative changes off the back of that next year?
Yeah, in fact, we had a major intervention this year, and it was successful.
Right.
We actually were able to drive those injuries down significantly, particularly in the preseason. That's where we really put our focus, because how we bring players back, first 2 weeks of training camp and the rest of preseason, has a big ripple effect for the rest of the season, because a lot of guys get hurt in preseason and they'll have a nagging injury throughout the entire
right.
season. So we did spend some dedicated time in the offseason working with clubs on that. We did see that pay dividends. We were down about 20% overall in those soft tissue strains during our preseason,
okay,
which is a pretty significant drop. And then we saw almost a 50% reduction in recurrent injuries during the regular season. So there's more work to be done, but we're definitely seeing the early returns from that effort of working with clubs on that. And sometimes people ask, well, why are you guys focused so much on that? Hamstring strain, soft tissue strains, number one burden injury in the NFL.
Yeah.
That means that guys miss more time for that injury than for any other injury. And so it's a natural point to focus on because that's what keeps players off the field.
Yeah, as analysts, once I hear hamstring, I'm like, uh-oh, you know, it's week one, it's week two.
Yeah.
Is this going to be a thing through
right.
week 10,
right.
week 15? Have you, with the soft tissue injuries, how much of that is like the last 10 years just less practice time? And how do you balance, you know, the players have been fighting for fewer practice reps and everything.
Yeah.
How do you balance practice time and how did you go about implementing, you know, a better ramp up period?
Well, you're right. There is a sweet spot there. You've got to do enough training to get prepared to the demands of the game, but you don't want to overtrain. So one of the neat things now compared with 10 years ago is we just have so much more data. Every player, as you know, wears a GPS tracking chip in practices and games. So we know how far they ran, how fast they ran, how many high-speed efforts and all that. We can really try to use that to go back to clubs and say, hey, these are the things we think prepare players, but don't overdo it, you know, to the point of pushing them past that red line and getting them injured. So it's finding that balance of getting enough high-speed efforts. Interestingly enough, one of the things we look at is if guys don't play in preseason games, you got to find a way to get that game-level intensity before the start of the regular
right.
season, or they'll have that strain in the first couple weeks of the regular season.
Where are we now on the discussion when it comes to playing surfaces? Is there now a consensus in terms of what the safest playing surface is? Are we going to be moving towards one specific thing? And is something like, you know, the World Cup going to help that? They're having the World Cup final at MetLife Stadium. They'll have grass for that, I assume. This is a
yeah.
FIFA has grass for all their stuff. So are we, because there was always a kind of argument, right? Some people were saying there's clearly grass is the better surface. The players want grass. But there were other studies that said, actually, it's more complicated than that. We're not 100% sure.
Yeah. Well, it is a very complicated topic. So when you think about lower extremity injuries, playing surface is one of those components. But there are other components as well. When you dive into playing surfaces, though, you quickly realize we don't just have two surfaces, grass and artificial. We've got 30 different surfaces. And they're very, very different. You know, if you look at the different properties, you know, stiffness, firmness, thickness, moisture content, you know, coefficient of friction, all of these things are different. So we're trying to understand, are there specific characteristics that do correlate with injury? Because obviously you'd like to get rid of those things,
right.
whatever the surface. We're also looking now more at how do we drive the surfaces to be more consistent overall so that there's less variation when you go from place to place. Hard to do because we have a lot of different environments, right? Boston, Massachusetts, very
right.
different than Jacksonville, very different than Seattle. We were talking earlier about minor league baseball field. Same thing. You know,
yeah.
you've got a lot of environmental factors. But I think where we're going is, can we do better measurements to really characterize the field? Can we narrow the range of properties and get those fields to be more consistent? And then hopefully we continue to learn, are there specific surface characteristics that do correlate with injury? We are working with FIFA. We will learn from that. I mean, the reality is right now today, you can't grow a high-quality grass surface and keep it in for months inside to withstand the kind of forces that NFL
right.
players put on it. That's an important point because they're
very,
very different than soccer players.
FIFA, yeah.
But we're working with them to learn about that effort and how that might be evolved because, you know, we'd love to get to the ability to have those surfaces, as I said, that are uniform across the league.
How much of the surface question is actually what's under the surface? Because if you go back and watch, like, old tape, it's like the AstroTurf back when
yeah.
was like a carpet laid on top of concrete.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, there's presumably varying levels of padding and whatever else goes under the surface in each individual stadium.
It's absolutely correct. It's a great observation. There are clearly differences in construction underneath. And again, whether you're talking artificial or grass.
Right.
And there's also a third category. It's called a hybrid surface, which is mostly grass but with some fibers of artificial worn woven within it. So all of that has to be considered, and you're exactly right. What's underneath it, the drainage, the heating, all of that plays a role. So we're working not only with FIFA but leagues all around the world. You know, when we do our international games, we go and meet with those international soccer leagues and others, and we're trying to understand what are they doing, how do they regulate it, how do they measure it, and how might that translate to the NFL. So there's going to be a lot more we're going to know about this in a year or two than we do today.
Right.
Why do you think the players, it feels like the Players Association is getting very aggressive with their fight for grass over turf. And yeah. I know you said there might be 30 surfaces rather than, you know, A or B.
Yeah.
Why are they so aggressive at this point, especially if, say, you guys are looking at data, they have data. If everyone's looking at the same data, why are they so aggressive with grass?
Well, I think we do share all the same data. And our engineers and their engineers are the ones who work together on this. I mean, they're very collaborative, and they have the same goals in this. I think it's well known that many artificial surfaces actually return a lot of energy to the body. So you put force in the ground and it kind of comes back into your body. That's going to make you sore. You're going to have some soreness. You're going to have, if you've got a chronic tendonitis in your knee, you're going to feel that. So I think, you know, players' input and players' preference absolutely matters. You also have to consider, though, the performance aspect. What surface do they feel they can perform the best on? Because we could make a surface, for example, that no one ever had a knee injury on, but people would fall down all the time. It'd be so slick. You can't perform on that. So it's finding that balance of performance, comfort, safety, consistency. That's really what we're trying to do together.
I was going to ask about that, the quality of the game, because I think the Patriots back in, I think it maybe 06 to 07, maybe went from grass to turf after they had their field completely torn up, and then eventually they started scoring more points once they went to turf and had a cleaner field. We've seen games, I think it was the 08 Dolphins-Steelers game, where it was just like puddles everywhere. It was 3-0 the game.
Yeah.
How much does the quality of the game factor in? I know you're focused more on the injury aspect. Who's making that final call with, you know, quality of the game versus, you know, keeping guys safe?
Well, safety really is our top priority, and that's always going to drive the conversation. But I think, again, consistency. How do you get to that consistent surface so that there's less variability?
And, that makes
sense. You go back and you look at video from 20 years ago. Let's go back to baseball. We used to play in baseball stadiums, right? Remember when there was dirt?
Yeah,
the infield stadium. Dirt that was actually part of the field? I mean, that's not that long ago.
It was aesthetically pleasing, though. It was fun. It's like, all right, this is a September game, you know?
Right. So there's a lot more work to be done. Yeah. We have come a long way. But, again, our ability to test and measure that. And, by the way, fields actually vary depending on where you are on the field, too. Imagine between the hash marks.
Sure.
Very different than the end zones from the side. So, again, the goal is, how do you make that homogeneous field that is safe and plays well all throughout? And we're just developing better tools and a better understanding of that. But we have the same exact goal of the Players Association. We want the best field that's safe, that you can perform on, and that you can maintain over time throughout the course of our season, which, again, goes from very, very hot weather to some very, very frigid weather.
Very true.
Late part of the season.
Are there times when, you know, safety is a top priority? Are there times where something else will stop something happening that would be a safety improvement? So the guardian caps, those kind of oversized rugby scrum cap things, those are now mandatory, right, in practices, contact practices, preseason, training camp, all that kind of thing. So presumably they make a tangible, provable difference to concussions, those kinds of things. What's stopping them being mandatory for every game?
Yeah.
Why are they not? Why do we take them off once the game starts?
Well, the reason we started with practices is that's where we had the data.
Okay.
So guardian caps have been used at the collegiate level for probably a decade or more, and you've got over 100 NCAA schools that use them. And we had lots and lots of data to say, hey, in a practice environment, they're safe.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you think about any new innovation, yes, you want to make sure that it's doing what you expect it to do, but you don't have an unintended consequence as well.
Sure.
So it was important for us to do it incrementally, to look at, hey, what is this going to do? Are there any potential downsides? When you talk about gameplay, we did not have any of that data, right? It hasn't been worn at games at other levels until recently. This fall, you saw a couple of high schools do it in Minnesota. Last spring, you saw, for example, Colorado wear it in their spring game. We think there may be a couple this year. And we've gotten that data. We're analyzing it. We're looking at it. But again, before we can say, it's okay to do in game, we just want to make sure there's not any unintended consequence or anything that might create a situation of a lack of safety.
So does that mean we're heading to a situation where those become the norm in game, and it's just we have to do it incrementally and make sure it's the data scales, right?
Yeah,
it translates.
We're continuing to research it, but where I think we're really heading is, how do you take that pretty simple add-on, a piece of padding, and actually incorporate it into the helmet itself?
So that's where
rather
I was,
than a shell on the outside, let's think about how it could be part of the construction.
That was the other thing I was wondering is, you know, we've been locked into this world of hard shell outer football helmet forever, right? And they've changed, you know, we're now getting all these kind of creases and areas where there's absorption and all that kind of thing.
Right.
But we haven't taken the kind of fundamental step of, what if it looked more like a rugby scrum cap or more like a guardian cap? Is that where this is going to head at some point?
Sam just wants to turn it into rugby. He wants more laterals and he wants more rugby.
There's always a hidden agenda there, right? You found it. No, listen, I think we've seen tremendous innovation in the helmet space in the last 10 years, full stop. But I think the next 5 years are going to be even more. We're looking at things like position-specific helmets. Why should every guy on the field wear the same helmet,
right? That's smart.
It turns out that certain players get hurt in certain ways. For example, quarterbacks, where do they get concussed? Usually in the back of the head. They're throwing the ball, they fall,
the Tua
protected
play.
Fall, yeah. Hits the ground. So this year you saw quarterback-specific helmets with extra padding in that area. Linemen, O-line, D-line, a lot of frontal impacts. Right. Why not reinforce that area? So I think over the next 5 years you'll see different materials, you'll see different design, and you'll see helmets tailored to specific positions. But one other really important point, the helmet's never going to be the be-all and end-all to prevent it against concussion.
Sure.
It's equally important that we look at the game and say, how can we take head contact out? I think of the helmet as kind of like the airbag or the seatbelt in your car. It's there if there's a crash. Safest thing is to avoid the crash in the first place. So I think both parts of that approach are important.
Roughly, would you say more concussions in the run game or the pass game? Do you have a feel for that?
Yeah, right now it's the passing game.
Yeah.
So, the statistically most numerous positions affected are wide receivers and defensive secondary. You know, yeah. Safeties, DBs, who are typically colliding in space and either going up for a ball, falling to the ground, or colliding with each other.
So you got that, the push and pull I think I've seen in the last 15 years is the NFL's made more rules to, you know, lead to more passing, right? The rules are favoring the passing game,
right.
So how do you balance the rules to make the game more exciting, pass game leads to more points versus the safety of players.
You know, one of the things that the commissioner always says is he believes the game can be safer and more exciting.
Yeah.
Those are not mutually exclusive. And I think that's our challenge. How do we keep the game exciting, preserve all the things that fans love to watch, but try to make incremental safety improvements? And that's what we spend our time and energy thinking about throughout the year and in the offseason.
And when you're talking about, you know, we want to try and take the head out of the game, and this is the same conversation that basically every sport is having, right?
Yeah.
Rugby, same thing. How do we get these head collisions out of it? Obviously, part of the way of doing that is by legislating new rules, different rules, try and punish those hits. But the other element has always got to be, let's make sure we are coaching that element as well. And I feel like whether it's head contact stuff in football or whether it's the hip drop tackle that's now a big talking point as well, I feel like football has had this tackling technique problem for years now that hasn't been addressed the way it has in some other sports. And it's a really fundamental coaching technique difference between football and other tackling sports that, you know, rugby has this saying cheek to cheek, right? Head cheek against butt cheek. That's the way you avoid the head contact, you get it out of it. Football almost teaches the exact opposite from a fundamental level. You put your head on the other side, you get more mass in front of them, you stop the forward progress. So how do you guys work with, instead of saying, let's just change every rule and make all of these plays illegal, we've also got to try and, because the pushback is, well, how am I supposed to tackle them?
Yeah.
Well, there is a way, we're just not teaching
That's
you
right.
that yet.
Yeah, I'm going to take this guy on the road with me. Okay?
Let's go.
He's finally got his dream. We're going to get it all going
role,
here.
Look, I've got an agent over here. We'll do the paperwork. We got it done.
No, you're absolutely right. A couple of points I'd like to emphasize. We'll never legislate head contact out of the game through rules. Full stop.
Right.
It is about technique. And you can tackle or block or execute any move using your head or not using your head. And we see that. We see that in the data. We see now that we can track head contact. Some offensive linemen that have a very high rate of head contact nearly every play, others that are way, way, way lower than that, two or three times lower. And so you're right on the money that coaching and teaching and emphasizing that is going to be a big part of the solution. You know, it's always said you can't change what you can't measure, right?
Right.
So being able to measure that is the first step. And we actually were able to do that this year. Now through using an artificial intelligence computer vision program, we can measure head contact, for example, O-line, D-line. And we actually gave that data to our teams on a weekly basis, but on a per player. You know, we like, hey, this is your player's rate of head contact. I think we've got to continue to emphasize more and more of that data, and we've got to work with coaches just on what you talked about. How do you block and tackle in the safest way that gets the head out of there? Again, always be some inadvertent contact. Players, you know, collide when they don't mean to or they hit the ground. But that technique-based tackle or block, getting the head out of that is a super important part of this. And that's not a rule change. That is coaching and teaching and emphasis.
And is it harder to do in the NFL because theoretically you want to be getting to those changes when they're kids?
Absolutely.
You want to be getting to it way before they get anywhere near the NFL.
Again, you're right on the money. We have to continue to work with other leagues and levels of play to say, hey, this is the safe way to play the game. You can still be effective. It's not any less effective.
Right.
But it's a safer way to do it, and it's going to extend your career and actually make you equally successful but healthier throughout because you're not going to have the risk of injury.
Right.
Sam, you're going to teach our youth
how to
tackle?
I'm here. Look, I said Solf's the agent. We'll talk to him. We'll work the numbers out, but I'm available. I'm available and willing to help.
Can we wrap it up with this? Real quick, hip drop tackle is a big talking point this offseason. Any changes coming with that?
It's an active conversation. Listen, this isn't just a unilateral decision for me or the league. Obviously, our competition committee and our coaches, players, everybody's going to have input into that. But, you know, when we started looking at specifically high ankle sprains and fractures of the lower leg, that particular style of tackle really jumps out because it has an astronomically higher injury rate. So I think it has to be a conversation where you say, okay, we're seeing this, it's leading to injury. Is it something we can change? But it'll be a broad off-season conversation.
All right, Dr. Alan Sills, Chief Medical Officer in the NFL. Appreciate the time.
Thanks for having me.